freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Jason Rocek. Thanks for joining us today. The goal of this podcast is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our republic. If you'd like to send us your questions and comments, please send them to freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. I'd love to hear what you enjoy about the podcast and how it's affected the way that you view liberty, our Constitution, and our country. Our sponsor this week is conservativeeconomy.com. We now have a free speech alternative to Amazon. It's conservativeeconomy.com. Why continue to send your money to Amazon when they are canceling and censoring those who stand up for liberty, when you can spend your hard-earned money with freedom-loving companies who share your values and principles? We have tons of companies to shop from with over 500 categories of products, with more being added every week. So chances are you'll find what you're looking for at conservativeeconomy.com. If you shop at a business that you love and you think that business would be a great fit at conservativeeconomy.com, go to our contact page and let us know. If you own a business, go to the sell here link at conservativeeconomy.com and tell us about your business. Again, that website is conservativeeconomy.com. Okay, let's get into today's episode. You may have noticed that my normal co-host, Matt Nugent, is not with us today. He has some very important stuff that he's working on, but we are very fortunate. I am thrilled to have with me a very old friend of mine, old in the sense of I've known him a long time, and that is Glenn Whitner. Glenn, thank you for joining us on this episode. Very much appreciate it. So Glenn is, I'll give you a background on Glenn, honestly, and he can jump in and fill in anything that I've missed. But Glenn and I have known each other since about 1994-ish, when I first got to West Point. He was a year ahead of me there. He's a West Point grad. And we got, years. Yeah, how many?
24 years.
Oh my goodness. Yes. So 24 years, right? So I only met him at West Point. We were in the same club together. And so I knew him throughout the 4 years we were there. Come to find out, he and I went to the same exact high school. He was 4 years ahead of me because he had done some prior service in the Army. But Glenn has been I didn't even realize this, but, and I don't know if any of you do, did you realize there was an airborne armor unit? I didn't know that until I met Glenn. He was actually an airborne armor cav scout in the Army before he went into West Point. And then afterwards, he branched infantry. So Glenn, again, welcome and thank you. What did I miss? Anything else everybody should know about you? I know you're happily married. You've got six kids. What else?
Six kids, one in college, five still here. My wife, the angel and saint that she is, homeschools all of them. And let's see, I'm a fitness instructor, a firearms instructor, and I did 24 years in the military, and happy to be here and support you on the podcast.
Yeah, no, I very much appreciate it. And as modest as he is, he left out his current venture, and that is he is currently the director of business development at conservativeeconomy.com. So very instrumental. Yep, very instrumental in all the success that we've had so far and that we will have in the future. Okay, so having said that, the title of today's episode is Article 1, Section 7, Passing Bills and Resolutions in Congress. So this will be a two-parter. Article 1, Section 7 is not super long, but there's two distinct parts to it, and I thought it'd be best to break it up. So today we're just talking about the clause that deals with passing bills and resolutions in Congress. So as a quick review, Article 1 is all about Congress. Article 1, Section 1, our basically says our legislature is bicameral, meaning that it is comprised of two branches or chambers and is granted all lawmaking authority by our Constitution. And again, I can't stress this enough. No one else is allowed to make laws in our nation except for Congress. Article 1, Section 2 deals with the House of Representatives. Article 1, Section 3 deals with the Senate. Section 4 deals with the times, places, and manner that congressional elections can take place. Section 5 deals with addressing how Congress may conduct business in their respective chambers. And then Section 6, which we dealt with last week, deals with congressional pay and privileges. So if you missed any of those episodes, they're all archived for you with our notes and everything on our website at patriotcoalitionlive.com. So again, to getting into today's topic, we're talking about Article 1, Section 7. It says, and I'll read, as we normally do, directly from the Constitution. It says, quote, this is Clause 1, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. Now, many mistakenly believe that this section applies to spending money as well as raising revenue, but it clearly states, quote, for raising revenue. So this is basically how they are able to bring money into the treasury. When we will talk ad nauseum about how we spend money or should spend money. Coming up here in a couple of weeks, we'll get into Article 1, Section 8, and it's all about that with the enumerated powers. We're going to dig deep into that. We'll talk about how the general welfare is misused and abused over and over again. And so there's more to follow on that. So if we are dissatisfied with how our representative is spending our money or they're voting on spending the money, we only have to wait at most 2 years to replace him, right? And that was one of the key features of why they ultimately decided on that all bills for raising revenue originate in the House. I should say, if we're not satisfied with how they're voting on raising our taxes, right? Not necessarily spending. So one of the, you know, we always like to go back to the original documents. So, you know, we do our research in the, on the Constitutional Convention. We want to know what the state of mind is, what the context was when they were discussing and deciding what was going to go in the Constitution. So one of the delegates in the Constitutional Convention, his name is Yates. He actually took notes. So these are some notes that he took on Elbridge Gerry, one of the other delegates. He said, Mr. Gerry moved that the first branch shall have the only right of originating bills to, quote, supply the treasury. So it talks to their frame of mind that they're only talking about how we're going to get money into the treasury. Who gets to decide that, right? So again, going on with some of Elbridge Gerry's comments, he says, the House of Representatives was more immediately the representatives of the people, and it was a maxim that the people ought to hold the purse strings. Well, this makes sense, right? I mean, if we are close, if we want to make sure that we retain very close control on who gets to decide how much money they're going to take out of our bank accounts, you know, in today's world, right? So those people are the ones that we're electing every 2 years. And they're the ones that are closest to us in terms of, you know, it's not a state senator where they represent, you know, 24 million people. They only represent, you know, close to 800,000. So
this is where, you know, I had that question on if there's to represent the people more accurately, why do we have people who are in office for decades upon decades? In fact, I think the person who holds the record was in there just shy of 60 years. You know, so when you have somebody who's representing us for 60 straight years, how does he actually know what the people really want and what the people need? It seems to be when we have these people like Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and all these people who've been there for decades and decades, they've lost touch with reality. Because of the environment they find themselves, with the American people. And so the American people are upset, but at the same time, like you said, it's our choice to vote them in. And we won't go into voter fraud, but at the moment, the issue is, you know, the intent might not be the actual what's being executed.
Yeah, no, you make a great point, right? If you're in office that long, it's a natural progression that those representatives probably, I don't want to say care less and less about what their constituents think, but they realize that they're pretty secure in their positions and they probably don't have to respond as, you know, as nimbly as, you know, they don't have to be as responsive to them to know that they're still going to get elected if that's what they seek, right? So it's a great point. So how is it that they're, even if they're closer to the people, if they're not as responsive, that kind of breaks the spirit of what they're trying to get to here.
Well, it's the old maxim, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Yep.
And the problem that we have in government, with government being corrupt, is that you have the same people, not only in the Congress, but in the infrastructure of government. You have these bureaucracies that are in power, and these people who've been in place for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, and that kind of power, that kind of authority tends to corrupt and make people feel like they're omnipotent.
Yeah, the longer they're in there, the longer they've just kind of been getting the check mark on the ballots every time, the more probably comfortable they are in saying, yeah, we could probably raise taxes a little bit more. There's a few pet projects that I could fund so that I get that golden parachute when I get out of Congress and I can get somebody to scratch my back, right? But you also pointed out, you know, some, a previous discussion that we had that, you know, ultimately, whose responsibility is it to make sure that if we don't like that person in office, we have to vote them out? Now, that's easy to say when you and I, you know, Glenn is here in Texas with me. You and I are here in Texas. You know, we don't like, let's say, what Nancy Pelosi's doing or, you know, Chuck Schumer or, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is doing, right?
Yeah. Special kind of stupid.
But we should we have a right to say, no, we don't want them to be in Congress anymore? No, we don't, right? Because we don't want their constituents saying, oh, you know what, Ted Cruz, we don't like that guy. And so he should be out of office, right? So we definitely have to respect the structure of how they're elected. But to the point that we made earlier, if they keep getting elected, it's because their electorate continued to elect them. They're not dissatisfied enough in that district where they kick them out. And so therein lies the problem, right? It's, okay, so they represent you know, 800,000 Americans. Now, when you get to Nancy Pelosi's stature and now you're in charge of Congress, again, it's difficult for us to swallow, but our representatives, yours and mine, both had a vote in whether or not she was elected. So again, the majority rules, unfortunately. But you bring up a great point, and it's something we can't forget about. I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, voting, you know, trying to get term limits and so forth. And we'll probably have a discussion on that in a different episode, because there's a lot to say about that, honestly.
So I was looking in my little book here, the Constitution.
Yeah.
And I have to be honest that before engaging in this podcast, I've never read the Constitution from cover to cover. I've read portions of it because I'm educating my children. But
yeah.
In reading it cover to cover, it's pretty enlightening. And I'm kind of like, wow, I didn't really know that. But I'm trying to find the quote. I probably won't find it right now. But I think it was from George Washington. He said one of the most important things, and I'm paraphrasing here, is that we educate the younger generations on statesmanship and politics.
Right.
And the problem that we have now is that in our microwave, Zoom, cell phone chain generation, all the information is so quick and so immediate. And then you have the social media networks and everything. People still don't realize the importance of civic duty and getting out and voting and understanding what they're voting for and who they're voting for and why they're voting for them.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. I didn't really pay much attention to it up until about the last, you know, 4 years.
And you're not alone. I mean, I think that, you know, both in understanding and reading the Constitution and in civic engagement, I mean, there are millions and millions of Americans out there who are in the same boat or are just now becoming, you know, entering what I call the awareness phase, where like, oh, maybe this stuff is really something I should start digging into.
Right. And like we talked earlier, yesterday, getting into your local politics, you know, because local politics affect you immediately.
Yes, that's
and
right.
A lot of people don't understand, like you were talking about knowing your sheriff. I'm like, I have no idea who my sheriff is. I'm like, I wrote that note down. I'm like, I need to find out who this guy is.
Yeah.
And go introduce myself and say, hey, you know, how are you doing? You know, so I can get to know who he is. So I know whether I need to vote for him next time.
Yeah. Here in Texas, you know, we don't have a state income tax, but we have, you know, pretty hefty property taxes. And so here in Texas, the majority of the money that gets taken out of our paychecks or that we have to send into a government entity is locally driven. The majority of it is. Yeah. There's still some at the federal level, but regardless, you know, all politics is local, and here in Texas, even more so. So
getting back to the point, you know, we need to vote, and we need to vote these people in or vote them out. But and one of the things that we're trying to do with Conservative Economy is getting the right people, moral, ethical, God-fearing people into government so we can get our country back on track.
Yes, sir. It's a great and lofty goal. It's good stuff. Sure. So getting back to Article 1, Section 7, Clause 1, talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, right? So there's also one of the delegates in the Constitutional Convention, General Pinckney. He mentioned that the Constitution is now evaded by informal schedules of amendments handed from the Senate to the other House, right? So, and his point here is that because the Senate has longer tenure, right? 6-year terms rather than 2 years, right? They can kind of wait out. You know, there's a little bit of churn over there in the House of Representatives. Some of them are going to leave, some are going to come in. It's not as stable. They can't form cabals as easily. And that's my words, not his. He's saying in the Senate, you know, we can kind of watch that over there, even though they have the power to raise revenue. And they have to initiate the bill. We can kind of see how the process works as they come and go every 2 years. Those of us over here in the Senate, or those people in the Senate, we can say, yeah, you know, when the next session starts, we should have a spending bill ready for them. And even though we can't introduce it, we'll give it to them so that they have something to start with, right? So Pinckney is saying here that, yes, even though you say that the House of Representatives can is the only one who can introduce bills for raising revenue, there is a way around that. And he is right. And so then we have to depend on the character of those men and women in the House of Representatives to make sure that they're not just being, you know, guided by the nose ring. And then there's Colonel George Mason, who is pretty active in the Constitutional Convention. He said, quote, should the Senate have the power of giving away the people's money, they might soon forget the source from whence they received it. So remember back then, before the 17th Amendment, which we talked about in previous episodes, the Senate represented the states. They were not elected by the people. They were elected by the state legislatures. And so the Senate represented the states. Well, if they were given the power to spend money, they were already separated from the people by one governmental entity, meaning the state legislature. So if they were given the power to raise revenue, it might be pretty easy because they don't feel the heat from the general public because they're not elected by them. And so Mason's point was that it's probably not a good idea to have the Senate in charge of raising revenue and taking people's money. In the Constitutional Convention at that time, they were actually considering both raising revenue as and appropriations or spending money combined. Later, they ended up separating that out in the final version.
So I would like to draw a point here, kind of going back to my first point, where we have the longevity in the Senate and in the House that is such that you have people like, for example, Nancy Pelosi has been there for 34 years, like since 1987. Mm. And Chuck Schumer has been there for over 40 years. And I think he was in both the House and the Senate. He's now in the Senate. The problem that we have is that they are doing unconstitutional spending.
Yes.
That they're not being held to account for that unconstitutional spending. For example, this last monstrosity of a stimulus bill, only 9% of that was actually went to any kind of stimulus or bailout for the American people. The rest of it was spread across, you know, God knows where, and like $48 billion was sent out to other countries. You know, I'm sorry, I don't feel as an American that I should be funding any other country or giving money to any other country.
Yeah.
And I don't think we should be putting ourselves in more debt to give money to other countries or to give money to the spotted, you know, polka dot frog down in Venezuela that might or might not cure cancer. It's like, okay, I'm not interested in the mating habits of, you know, the blue cockatoo.
Right.
You know, but apparently, you know, they send millions of dollars. You know, when our country is going through a crisis, they have funded millions upon millions of dollars to the arts foundations and stuff up in New York and a whole bunch of different constituencies.
Right.
And I understand that each senator wants to get a piece of the pie. They want something for their people. But the problem that we have is that the people who help these individuals get elected, they want their pay. They want their cut. They want their pay.
Well, that's it exactly, right? It's not that they're trying to get something for their constituents. You know, that may be the pretense, right? But the in actuality, it's the people who are getting them elected, the people who are giving them money, or the promise of, hey, once you're out of Congress, you know, I'll help you in Congress. But once you're out of Congress, we've got something very nice lined up for you, as we call it, the golden parachute. So while you're in there, you know, do us some solids and we'll hook you up afterwards, right? That's the sort of corruption that that we'd like to avoid. But your point and your question, you know, I take it as essentially, how are they getting away with this outrageous spending that's going on, right? Yeah,
exactly.
Well, and we've already talked about one of the things is, well, when your representative or your senator is voting for these bills that have all this nonsense in them, they are essentially dishonoring the oath that they took to support and defend the Constitution. They took an oath to do that. Same oath you and I and Matt and a lot of our brothers and sisters in arms took to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That you can't defend the Constitution while you're simultaneously violating it. And what do I mean by that? Well, we're going to talk about this in probably a couple of weeks. But in Article 1, Section 8, we have all the enumerated powers that tell us exactly what we can spend what the Congress can spend money on. Actually, it tells them exactly what they may or may not legislate on. I mean, all these things that you've mentioned, you know, the mating habits of cockatoos or the blue speckled frog in Venezuela, those are not listed in Article 1, Section 8. And so every time they vote for a bill that spends money outside of their authorized authority, they are violating the Constitution. And so we the people must recognize what their scope of authority is so that we can say, no, sir, no, ma'am, you may not do that. And if this continues, I'm going to find somebody else to replace you. And I'm going to get a bunch of my other friends, brothers and sisters who are as ticked off as I am that all my money is being spent elsewhere. And I'm going to, you know, kick you out of office. So right. That's one solution, right? Is we can't continue to send them back if they're doing the same thing. You know, that's insanity. The other thing is the separation of powers, right? Congress is one thing. They can pass bills all they want. And some of them may be legal. Most of them are not. We call those unconstitutional enactments as soon as they are signed by the president. But that begs the question. The separation of powers, the president is separate but equal from the Congress. When they send him an unconstitutional bill, he takes an oath that also says that he will support and defend the Constitution. If he signs that bill, he's doing the same thing. And every president has been signing these bills from Congress, these spending bills that authorizes money that they're not authorized to spend. You know, it reminds me, so most of the audience knows at this point that in 2020, I was a Republican candidate for Congress in my district here in Texas. During that campaign, one of the things that I was very focused on, one of the things was the amount of money that we're spending and how much of it was unauthorized. I actually went back into the 2019 fiscal year budget, the federal fiscal year budget of $4.5 trillion, and went line item by line item to determine whether or not it was constitutional spending in accordance with Article 1, Section 8. And would you believe that only one third of the spending in 2019 was constitutional? So only $1.5 trillion was constitutional. You know, that's like the military and other things like that. But
military infrastructure, you know, stuff that, you know, goes to taking care of the American people.
That's right. But $3 trillion was unconstitutional. You can translate that. If you spend 5 years of only spending a third of what you wanted to spend, we could make some pretty nice down payments on our national debt. But again, will we, the people, continue to allow these representatives to do this over and over again? So good question. So getting back to our clause today about the House of Representatives being the only ones that are authorized to raise revenue. Governor Morris, another delegate in Congress, I believe he's from New Jersey, delegate to the Constitutional Convention, I should say. He says it will always leave a plea as to an obnoxious money bill that it was disliked, but could not be constitutionally amended nor safely rejected. So at this point, he's talking about, you know, whether or not the Senate had any authority to either to veto it, if you will, or give their feedback on it. So, as the proposal stood at that time, the Senate could not even make amendments to House bills on raising revenue. They made it strictly in the House. But, Governor Morris is like, you know, that doesn't make sense, right? Because we, you know, our state still elected them. They are a party to this Constitution. They should have a say on whether or not and how we're raising that money. And if they see something that the knuckleheads in the House are doing wrong, they should be able to amend it at least, because ultimately both houses have to agree to it. So it's got to, both of them have to do that. So that kind of covers it. Again, it was a very short clause, that we talked about today. The rest clause two is a little bit longer, but both, it has two parts that we'll get into next week that are kind of similar. And so we'll look at the similarities and the differences there. But that covers it for there. So it was interesting because one of the things, as I said, Glenn and I have known each other for years, most recently, after he's retired and we both found ourselves in Texas, we got back in touch. He expressed to me, he's like, I keep hearing about this American experiment. It's frustrating. It's like, it's not an experiment anymore. And then, so during the research I was doing for this episode, I came across a quote in it's called the Records of the Federal Convention of 1787. That's where I do my research. And I came across this quote from one of the delegates, James Wilson. And he said, quote, but he was persuaded that on examination of the American experiment, it would be found to be a trifle light as air. And I don't remember the context of what he's talking about, but I just found it funny. And I had to mention it to Glenn that, hey, look, even back then in 1787, they were talking about the American experiment.
Yeah, it frustrates me that, people say the American experiment. It's like, well, at what point does it stop becoming an experiment and we're actually just a nation? We've been founded for well over, 46 years. Can't remember what our birthday is at the moment, but we've been around for a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
And we have suffered through a civil war. We've suffered through two different world wars, Korea, Vietnam. We are a nation, and the problem is that our current powers that be keep trying to separate us.
Yeah.
And not unite us. And using this, the American experiment, it's like, no, we're not an experiment anymore. We are a melting pot of multiple, hundreds of different cultures.
Right.
Hundreds of different peoples from all over the world. And for us to sit there and harp on, well, it's either black or it's white or it's Mexican or it's Asian or it's this. It's like, no. If you're an American, you're an American. And being an American is a unique designator. Okay. There's no other country like us on the planet. There's never been another country like us on the planet. And if we're not careful, there never will be again. So we have got to jealously guard against this idea that we're some kind of weird freak experiment and say, hey, no, we are a nation, And by the way, all of you other nations who weren't experiments, we bailed you out of, I don't know how many different, you know, hotspots. So yeah. For you to keep coming to the experiment to bail you out, you know, is kind of begs to question, are we still an experiment? Because it seems to be that what we're doing has been working for a number of years. We just got to get back on track.
Yes, sir. No, and to those members of Congress who keep thinking they need to tinker with things, right, with the experiment to make it, you know, oh, I don't really like this or I don't really like that. You got to stop, right?
It's, well, the idea that our Constitution is somehow flawed. It's like, I'm sorry. This is the longest, this is the oldest document that has ever been used to govern a country. And it is still as viable today as it was when it was written. And the men who wrote it, you're reading through this thing, these guys were brilliant.
Yeah, amazing.
It humbles me to think that I'm like, dear Lord, I got to get more educated. You know, my education wasn't thorough enough because these guys were extremely well written, but their thought process was so profound.
Yeah.
And one of the main reasons is because before they met, you know, I think it was Jefferson who said, we need to pray. We need to pray before Congress, before we start, you know, discussing how to create this document. And so this document has God's fingerprints all over it. And no matter how much our current government and the far left, you know, radicals want to take God out of our culture, I'm sorry, it's on our money. It's in our heart. It's on all our documents. We are a Christian nation that was founded on Judeo-Christian principles.
Yep.
And we should be afraid. We should fear taking that out of our government.
Yeah, because I tremble
if the hand
the
of
thought.
God is not yeah. on us, you know, we will crumble like Babylon, like Rome, like any other empire, the Persian Empire, any other organization that had a stranglehold or a control over a certain area. You know, it's like, look, you know, you can go back to the, you know, what we did to the Indians. And yes, that was bad. It was horrible. But at the same time, we were nation building. So it's a whole different world. I get so frustrated when we take the moral principles of today and try to pin them on the people who are dead, who had to execute that in the absence of orders, in the absence of understanding. They did what they had to do because that's what they had to do.
Yep.
It was over 130-140 years ago. And, you know, it's like, I'm not
they were
second
they were
guess
finding
them.
Their way
there.
And they're making mistakes just yeah. as like we'll continue to make mistakes. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So it's unnecessary for us to apologize for somebody else making their mistakes. Well, back then it wasn't a mistake.
Yeah,
it's a mistake now, according to your moral, ethical, you know, compass. But back then it wasn't a mistake. That they were doing what they knew to be right or what they thought to be right.
Right. No, well said. I mean, you know, and that's why one of the main pillars of this podcast is, you know, to learn and to preserve and to teach about our Judeo-Christian ethic, because that is, you made the point, and I think it was Franklin, it wasn't Jefferson who urged everyone to pray, but nonetheless, the point is the same. And you made the point, it's funny, you took it right out of the words right out of my mouth. I was going to mention that, the fact that, you know, this document, this Constitution is the longest, you know, it our government has been in effect the longest under one document, longer than any other nation in the history of the planet. And that is something. So again, to your point about, you know, the experiment is over. Yeah, I would say so. Right. So now it's up to us to figure out where we're going to go from here. So, well, good. No, this has been a great episode. You know, Glenn, I mean, you laid it out perfectly for everyone, but any final thoughts on what we talked about or anything else?
So a lot of people that I talk to, the biggest question they have, and I think we've touched on a little bit of how to solve that problem throughout the podcast, is what do we do now? Or how do we fight back? Or how do we, what is our next step in order to, you know, defeat, you know, like you all like we'd like to say, the three-headed monster, the three-headed beast. How do we defeat them? I mean, they're so powerful. Well, you know what? Goliath was pretty powerful too. And little David, you know, knocked him out with a stone and then chopped his head off. So, right. I mean, great things can be done as long as we have God at the center of what we're trying to do. And we have prayer, and he will fight for us if we only ask and we are within his will. But yep. We still need to have a plan. We still right. need to have a way forward.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of these things that I always like, just the way that my mind works. I always like to drive at the root cause of everything to make sure that we're not just chopping at the limbs, but we're hacking at the limbs, but we're chopping at the root of the problem. Right. So in right. my mind, there's three, well, there could be more than this, but to be very basic about it, one, we've already talked about a little bit, and that is we got to vote people out who are not honoring the oath that they took to support and defend the Constitution, right? That's a, right. a sacred and solemn oath that they took. It's not just like check the block to get into Congress or whatever. We've got to hold them to that. And that means sometimes we may have to make hard decisions. You know, somebody who's a very popular representative and that's on your team may be doing the wrong things too often. And that means finding somebody to run against them in the primary and supporting them. And to your point about, you know, they may have been there too long and they're getting a little bit too comfortable. So in order to vote them out, we've got to get involved in politics. I know people say politics is dirty. It's not politics that's dirty. It's the people involved in politics who have the right. capability to be dirty. Politics is just a tool. It is the last nonviolent means by which we can restrain our government. And so we better, I posted the other day on social media, if we don't use politics for good, someone else is likely going to use it for evil. So you've got to get involved in politics. And that means, you know, you go knocking on doors for candidates. You donate to candidates. You support them in whatever way. You spread the word about them. You go and meet them and then tell other people around you, hey, I actually met this person. He shares our values and principles, et cetera. So you got to get involved in politics. It can't just be limited to going to vote, although that is a very solemn duty as well. It's got to be more than that. The second thing that we've talked about this in previous episodes is called interposition, right? That's, you know, if someone is over on this side trying to take away your liberty and you're over here trying to hold on to your liberty, interposition is some entity or some person stepping in between that and trying to stop the one who's trying to take away your liberty. Interposition, right? So that looks like, and I always use this as an example. If, let's say, all this nonsense with the gun grabbing, executive orders is going to come to fruition, and we get in a situation where, you know, they're going to look up and say, oh, yep, I think you bought some AR-15 parts that you shouldn't have bought or we don't think you should have. We're going to come and collect those from you, right? So that is a threat to liberty, right? Interposition would mean, let's say here in Texas, you know, DPS troopers that were deployed by hopefully our governor would be there to greet the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and say, I'm sorry, this you don't have the proper authority to go and take these weapons. They are lawfully, or weapon parts, they are lawfully owned and you shall not pass, right? And so they just stand up for it and then put the burden on the federal government or the central government in this case to say, okay, are you going to physically assault state troopers in order to get into the house or not? And this gets back to our conversation about, you know, get to know your county sheriff, right? That sheriff, we're electing him. He is beholden to nobody but us and the Constitution, obviously. And so if you don't have a county sheriff who's willing to stand between you and someone who's trying to take your liberties away from you, you need to find another sheriff. I'm proud to say that I have a fantastic sheriff here, and he's stated on multiple occasions, there will be no gun grabbing going on. So that's interposition, right? Those are a couple of examples. Right. And so we've got to encourage these state officials or county officials and put them on the spot and say, what happens in this situation? Are you going to step in between me and somebody trying to take my liberties, even when it's unpopular? And then, you know, the final thing is, you know, we've got to stop supporting those who are working against us, right? Right now we are spending, I think the number from January is the average family spends Matt's going to kill me because I'm probably not going to get it right, but I want to say like $1,600 a year shopping online. That sounds really low. But anyways, we're spending way too much money on companies like
my family.
Yeah. On Amazon. Right. We know what Amazon does with the money. We know what the Bozo family, you know, Jeff Bozo and his ex-wife, they're spending money on people who are fighting against our liberties. So why are we going to continue to send money to them? It would be like us, you know, sending fuel to the Nazis while we're fighting them in World War II. Or as a friend of mine, you know, I think it was Todd, told me the other day, well, Ford Motor Company was making tanks for them. And I didn't remember that. Why would we do that? That's like shooting ourselves in the foot. So rather than sending money to your time and attention and your dollars, let's say to Amazon or Facebook or, you know, watching, you know, some mainstream media program, why not start supporting others that are not going to work against you? It seems simple to me. So obviously that means companies like conservativeeconomy.com, where we've got a ton of, right, of different businesses on there, where you go and say, look, this is not Amazon. You're not giving your money to the bozos. And you can spend money with small companies who are looking to support themselves and are going to have to share the same values and principles, right? Right. Or so at a very minimum.
Go ahead. Yeah, put your money where your mouth is.
Absolutely.
That's the biggest issue is I have tons of people that I talk to. They're like, oh, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. And they have Amazon showing up at their door. I'm like, well, if you think it's so wrong, okay, then why are you supporting? Why are you have more people going on Facebook? Why do we have, you know, why aren't we switching to MeWe or to Gab or to, you know, Rumble or to other conservative you know, sites that support what we believe. The problem is that these people are so big and are so ingrained, and they got big and ingrained before we knew what they really stood for.
That's right.
And then in this last year, they pulled back the curtain and said, hey, we don't like you people, but you can't do crap about it. Yeah. And we need to say,
they've abused our trust. They've abused the value that we've given them. And before, there wasn't really a great alternative, right? But now that there is, right? So again, help us to go and shop at conservativeeconomy.com. And so those are some of the things that we can do. We've got to start, as you said, put our money where our mouth is. We've got to get out and help those who are have the same values and principles as us who are running for office. And we've got to make sure that the people that we're putting in office are going to stand up for our liberties, even when it's inconvenient. So, all right, well, let's summarize this episode really quick. So again, in the Constitutional Convention, the framers settled on limiting the raising of revenue to the House of Representatives, or at least they gave the authority to the House to create the bills that were focused on raising revenues, in other words, taxes and so forth. So only the House can start those bills. The Senate can amend them, they can comment them on, they can debate them, but they cannot create those bills. And as we mentioned, in terms of appropriations, meaning how we then take that money that they've raised and appropriate to basically spend it on other things, we're going to talk about that in the enumerated powers of Article 1, Section 8 here, probably coming up in a couple of weeks. So, and then of course, as we said, the Senate still gets to have their say in amending, you know, and the final vote. So it's not like they're cut out entirely. So that's Article 1, Section 7 and Clause 1. So Glenn, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a fantastic discussion, and all my well wishes to you and your family, and just always appreciate getting together with you, brother, and talking about all this great stuff. So thanks for being here.
Cool. Airborne. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Folks, remember, again, that you empower those who whom you spend your time, attention, and dollars. So if you spend your dollars with Amazon, you empower them to cancel and censor people with conservative principles and to give billions, that's billions with a B, of dollars to the enemies of liberty. So now when you shop with freedom-loving businesses, like you'll find at conservativeeconomy.com, you weaken those who mean to do us harm, and you empower freedom-loving companies, and you help us out on this podcast at the same time. So come find some great products at conservativeeconomy.com. And if you're not already a regular subscriber of this podcast, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts at, places like iHeartRadio and Spotify. And, you know, again, Thanks again, everyone. We will see you here next time. Take care.
Awesome.